We're going to look at a landmark case that's just been heard by Canada's Supreme Court. Canada's Constitutional Foundation has called it the most important constitutional case in Canada in a generation. It's English Montreal School Board versus Quebec, and it's a challenge to a 2019 law passed by Quebec's legislature called Bill 21, an act respecting the laicity of the state. Bill 21 bans a host of Quebec public sector workers from wearing religious symbols at work and also bans face coverings for people receiving government services if an uncovered face is necessary for ID or security purposes. Dr. Kerri-Anne Frock is an Associate Professor of Law at the University of New Brunswick, and she represented Canada's National Association of Women in Law in the Supreme Court hearing. Dr. Frock, welcome to Sunday Extra.
Thank you. Good morning.
And you were far from alone in representing that case. It was a massive case, many parties involved. It's about whether Bill 21 was unconstitutional, but this case was heard 7 years after the law was passed. So have the bans been in place all this time? And if so, what impact have they had?
Well, there have been a variety of different laws, and they've gotten more and more stringent over time in Quebec, kind of culminating in this law, which was an absolute ban on people wearing religious symbols. But the brunt of the law really was experienced by Muslim women who wore the hijab, and mostly teachers, daycare workers, and the like. So as I understand it, they reported facing and experiencing, a lot of hostility from the population that ramped up after this law in particular was passed.
So the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms says in Section 2 that everyone has certain fundamental freedoms, one of which is freedom of conscience and religion. And then you've got Section 15 that guarantees equal protection of the law without religious discrimination. But there does seem to be quite a catch in the Charter. Could you tell us about the so-called notwithstanding clause?
Certainly. So Canada has a Bill of Rights, a written Bill of Rights, much like the United States has, although ours is of more recent vintage. Our Constitution was patriated, as we say, in 1982. And part of the compromise to get all of the provincial premiers and the federal government to sign on to it was the notwithstanding clause, as you say. And that clause allows government to declare that a law operates notwithstanding particular rights. And for the purposes of this appeal, the freedom of religion, the right to equality, those are the rights that are particularly at issue. So Quebec invoked the notwithstanding clause in this law. So the question is there anything else in our constitution that potentially could assist vulnerable minorities who are, like I say, experiencing some very difficult circumstances under this law?
Yes, I must say, from a distance, reading the clause about fundamental freedoms did make me wonder whether that clause was a bit mistitled, because if they can be overruled, they don't seem quite as fundamental as you might think on first reading. But as you say, the notwithstanding clause can only override some sections of the Charter. So what can't the notwithstanding clause apply to? And how did you personally deploy that limit in your arguments to the Supreme Court about the Bill 21?
Well, there's a provision in our charter that's called Section 28, and we call it Canada's Equal Rights Amendment. So the women in the United States lobbied very hard to get an Equal Rights Amendment in their constitution, and they weren't able to do so. But we in Canada were able to. But the issue has been that really over the last decades, the courts really haven't made use of that gender equality clause. But that is one clause that is not subject to the notwithstanding clause. So I'm one of the experts in Canada on that Section 28. I have been toiling in somewhat obscurity for, several years. And all of a sudden, I'm very popular these days because, like I say, when you have a law that disproportionately is impacting women, the question is, if it violates Section 28, then perhaps there's an ability for judges to really inquire into this law. Whereas before, it was thought invoking the notwithstanding clause means that courts kind of have to take a hands-off approach.
Yeah, so, and it's worth clarifying there. So the law on its face does it applies equally to men and women, but the argument that you're making is that it has a disproportional impact, in particular on women of Muslim faith, as you described, and therefore the argument is that it contravenes this equal protection clause. When you argued that before the Supreme Court, did you get a sense of how much engagement there might be from the bench with that proposition?
Well, it's really interesting because we have a number of women on our Supreme Court, three of whom were absolutely silent. So I don't know if that means that they've made their minds up and they're, hoping to maybe talk to some of their colleagues behind the scenes.
Can't tell whether
But
that's good
I
silence
don't
or
know what
bad
to make of
silence
it.
yet. Yeah, right. I see.
Yeah.
I see.
Yeah, it's hard to interpret silence. Some the male judges, one of whom seemed to be very questioning the parties closely as to the significance of the clause, because there's a debate in Canada whether it's simply interpretive or it can have, a more of a function. And other judges weren't engaged and are looking at other issues, such as can a court make a declaration, even if it can't strike down a law that has invoked the notwithstanding clause? Can they simply declare that rights have been violated to educate the public? Because one thing that is important to note is that the notwithstanding clause has what's called a 5-year sunset clause, with the idea being that if the electorate thinks that the clause has been invoked improperly, they can punish the government at the ballot box.
Yeah, that is really interesting and quite novel. Certainly not something that I think Australian listeners would be familiar with. And I suppose that really goes to the question of where the ultimate power lies in terms of deciding issues of fundamental rights. Is it simply the case that if a legislature invokes this notwithstanding clause and basically says, well, we're not going to worry about the fundamental rights, that that is something that's beyond the Canadian courts to rule against?
Yeah, so when the notwithstanding clause was first being discussed seriously, the premiers that came up with the idea had the notion that, sometimes, judges are human, sometimes they get it wrong, and if they get it wrong, then it should be the legislature should be able to kind of correct the course and declare that, or make some sort of adjustment by invoking the notwithstanding clause. And one of the premiers involved was actually quite progressive, and he was worried that maybe judges would, they were quite conservative, they're still somewhat conservative, that perhaps they would stymie his progressive agenda, and therefore he should be able to use the notwithstanding clause to be able to advance maybe rights that aren't expressly in our constitution, like the right to healthcare or the right to housing. So those were some of the concerns, and the charter was and is very popular, and the idea was that the electorate is not going to take very kindly to government's overriding rights. But with the growth of populism, there's become this hostility towards the rights of minorities. So we don't really know if that really holds today, if it ever did. So some people are calling on the Supreme Court of Canada to put some more guidelines, guardrails, if you will, on the use of the notwithstanding clause.
So after Quebec passed Bill 21, the secularism law, has the notwithstanding clause been invoked more often by Canadian lawmakers, whether in Quebec or beyond?
It was invoked very rarely, except Quebec for a while up into the mid-1980s. Quebec didn't like the way our constitution was patriated, so in protest, they were invoking the notwithstanding clause on each and every bill that they passed. But really, it's only been since the late 2010s that governments in Canada, Quebec included, have really ramped up either talking about the notwithstanding clause or actually using it. And it's really a different use than we've seen in the past, really about targeting minorities here, Muslim women, for instance. It's been used by a couple of other governments to pass what's called a parent's bill of rights, in relation to trans students who are afraid to tell their parents that they're trans, so they want to be out at school but don't want to necessarily tell their parents. So it's those kind of uses that are more concerning. So it's in the political ether here quite a bit more than it ever has been in the past, and used a bit differently than it has been in the past.
Yeah, certainly sounds like that dialogue between the judiciary and the legislature is quite robust. It was a big case. The submissions have about 25 pages of parties before you get to the actual arguments, but the case has now been heard. When is the Supreme Court expected to announce their decision? And Kerri-Ann, do you have a sense of which way you think it's going to go?
Well, it's really interesting because we usually have nine judges on the Supreme Court of Canada hearing cases. But in this case, we had one judge, Mahmoud Jamal, who the Attorney General of Quebec made a motion for him to recuse himself. And ultimately, he did voluntarily on the basis that he had previously represented one of the interveners in unrelated cases in the past. So we only have seven judges sitting, and one of them is going to retire at the end of May. So with the timelines that are in place, if she is going to participate in writing the decision, it has to come out by November. And if she doesn't, then we're back to an even number of judges. And I don't think anyone wants to see what would happen with that being the case. If we get a tie, this is going to be very problematic for the country. So I think we're looking at November in terms of how it's going to play out. I think that the court is going to be moved to maybe say that courts can make a declaration about the violation of rights. The problem is that sometimes declarations aren't really worth the paper that they're written on. Mm. There's no hammer that, there's no real remedy. For instance, a Muslim woman that's being affected by this law that, for instance, graduates from law school and can't become a crown prosecutor because of it. So what I'm hoping is that perhaps they'll be moved to say that, for instance, no matter what you want to do with the notwithstanding clause, it was very intentionally made so that equal rights were not to be touched. So I'm hoping that a majority of the court, we only need four, will be moved to make that kind of pronouncement. I just don't have a good sense of it at this point, whether that's going to happen.
Absolutely. Dr. Kerri-Ann Frock, thank you so much for joining us on Sunday Extra this morning.
Well, thank you.
That's Kerri-Ann Frock, Associate Professor of Law at the University of New Brunswick, and she represented Canada's National Association of Women in Law in the hearing of the English Montreal School Board versus Quebec case, which, as we heard, will hopefully have a decision out by November this year.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.